Empty words. We all are familiar with this, all familiar with empty promises, for instance. We've all heard expressions of condolence or encouragement, but they were really about as empty and vacuous as an empty bucket. Empty words are just that. They're words without action. We're used to hearing empty words, for instance, from Washington, where politicians make promises and then never intend to follow up. I was struck by this example from 1916. Woodrow Wilson was running for re-election, and his whole campaign slogan was, "He kept us out of the war." And what happened? Immediately after he was re-elected, he brought us into World War I. Again, it's what was said versus what was done. But we also are familiar with empty words, not just from politicians, but also from advertisers. We're used to being bombarded with ads telling us, buy this product and expect these results. If you've ever been up late night during infomercial hour, you've probably seen all these promises made. You know, this contraption can improve your health and fix your life and heal your relationships, all for 4 payments of $29.99. And if you ever, in a moment of weakness, decided to try out one of those quick fixes, you probably have been disappointed to realize, oh, it didn't live up to all the promises. What we have is big words, small results. Sadly, empty words are not just found in those sorts of places. They're also found in relationships. I find this to be very sad, that even in relationships, people will say things like, I care about you, I'm here for you, or even, I'm praying for you. But sometimes those turn out to be empty words, not a lot of action. Words, when they're not backed up by action, are just that. They're empty words. That includes, by the way, words of faith. People can say, I'm a Christian, I am born again, I worship the Lord, I'm a person of prayer. But those two, if not backed up by action, can be empty words. I think we're all familiar that the statistics in this country, at least as they're fed to us from the pollsters, is that religion in America is on the decrease. But do we understand that a lot of those polls are self-reporting? They're asking people, do you consider yourself to be a Christian, yes or no? Well, we understand. Anybody can say yes. It's not like they're checking that up. So we're all too familiar with religious language being used, but being just empty words. We've said from the beginning of our study, we've been working our way through the book of James, that this little letter is all about faith demonstrated, faith lived out, not just spoken, not just empty words, but faith demonstrated in how we live. And now James gets to what I think is a pivotal section in this whole book. This could be considered the core of the book of James. Faith without works. Now, when we talk about faith, we have to ask ourselves, what is that? What is faith? Is it just a profession of certain truths? Is it just saying, yes, I agree with these beliefs? Is it something that's emotional? Or is it something more than that? And that's what I think James is getting at. He's bringing us to this question of what does true saving faith look like? He says it pretty clearly here in verse 14. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? This is an important section. I think it's the core of the book of James in some ways, but also it's one of the most controversial passages in the book of James. Why? It's because it seems, at least to many people, to contradict what we read elsewhere in the New Testament, particularly in Paul's letters. Paul has said over and over again in the New Testament, faith saves, that we are saved by faith apart from works, that works are not part of what's required for a person, but faith alone. But James says that what good is faith if it doesn't have works? He even goes so far in verse 24 as to say that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. Again, this seems to fly in the face of what we read elsewhere. So it's been very confusing to some people. It posed a great difficulty, for instance, to Martin Luther, who, as you know, or likely know, he championed the idea of faith alone. But when it came to the book of James, he had a difficulty, and he, rather famously, he declared James to be a right strawy epistle. In other words, it wasn't as valuable as the other books of the New Testament. But we don't need to take that view. We don't need to take a low view of James to understand this. What we need to do is study the passage and try and grasp what James is saying, and then try and see what Paul is saying and see if we can harmonize those two. And that's what we're going to do in part as we work through this passage. The main objective in studying these verses this morning is to grasp what it is that James is telling us about faith. And if I could put it quite simply, it's this. True faith, that is, cannot be separated from its product, which is good works. Faith cannot be separated from that which it produces, good works. So the question to us is your faith more than just words? Is your faith just something you say? Or is there some evidence that it's resulted in the change of your life? Again, this is the burden that James has all throughout this book. Because anybody can say, hey, I'm a Christian, but where are the works? Where's the evidence to show it? So he begins in verse 14. Let's think through this together. What good is it, my brothers, if anyone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? The first observation that we want to make here in James chapter 2 is that faith without works is dead faith. Faith without works is dead faith. Now, previously, James has talked about faith demonstrated in how we treat others. The issue particularly was partiality in the first 13 verses of this chapter. So treating people based upon external, superficial factors. And James says, that's wrong. It's sin. You're not living your faith when you're doing that. So now he gets to the question of, well, what is real faith anyways? What does faith mean? Well, here he says, faith without works isn't the real thing. It's a counterfeit. It's a dead faith. In other words, there's something that looks like faith, claims to be faith, yet isn't living and active. And James, in the course of these 12 verses, 14 to 26, five different times restates this thesis. Faith without works is dead. Faith without works is dead. Faith is justified by its works. So let's look at verse 14 and talk here about the inefficacy of words, of dead faith. It's worthless. It doesn't do anything. So he begins by saying, what good is it? That's a nice question to make us stop in our tracks. He says, listen, what good is a faith that isn't a real faith? And it's a hard question, one that we need to pause with. You know, is your faith a good faith? Or are you just claiming things? Here's the claim, though. He says, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? So here you have somebody, a hypothetical person that James is introducing. He says, they have faith, or they say they have faith, but they don't have the works to back it up. There's no change in their life. There's no evidence of the Holy Spirit at work in their hearts. There's no love for the Lord. There's none of the things that you would expect to find of somebody who's living and growing in Christ. They say they have faith, but there's no evidence of that. It's a little bit like somebody saying, you know, I love you, but nothing in their conduct says that they actually love you. You would probably question whether or not they're just saying that. Or it's like somebody who says, oh, I really enjoy spending time with you. But then every time you try to spend time with them, they always come up with some lame excuse as to why they can't spend time with you. And you start to say, you know, you say that a lot, but I'm kind of wondering if it's true. That's what James is doing here. He's saying they claim to have faith, but it doesn't have the works. It doesn't have anything to prove that that's the case. Alexander McLaren, who wrote about 200 years ago, He said this, rather almost sarcastically, we could say. The people who least live out their creeds are the same people who shout the loudest about them. For some reason, the paralysis which affects their hands does not seem to interfere with their mouths. Again, some people are, hey, this is who I am, this is what I believe, but there's nothing to back that up. So James asks another question. He says at the end of verse 14, can that faith which is without works, that faith which has no evidence, can that faith save him? Now, James is not here saying what we need to be saved is faith plus our works. What he's saying is we need the right kind of faith. I think C.E.B. Cranfield, who was a biblical scholar from many years ago, I think he summarizes this very nicely. He says, the burden of this section is not that we're saved through faith plus works, but that we are saved through genuine as opposed to counterfeit faith. So what does real faith look like? Well, it doesn't look like it's dead on the floor. It's a living and active faith. And by the way, the end of verse 14, that question, expects a no answer. Can that kind of faith save him? No. You could almost translate this. Can that faith really save him? No. The answer is no. The inefficacy of dead faith. Secondly, though, James kind of gives way to this illustration of the emptiness of words. So in verse 15, he gives an illustration. James is so great about this. He's always bringing in some kind of an object lesson or an illustration of some kind to help us. And he does that here. He says, if a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one says to him, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving the things needed for the body, what good is that? Notice, by the way, the beginning of verse 14 and the end of 16, what good is it? What good is it? So what he's doing is he's illustrating the point he's just made. He says, just like words of faith, words of encouragement, if not backed up with action, are just words. Words with no effect. So he pictures somebody who's in rough conditions, right? Some versions will say he's naked. Probably the better translation is poorly clothed. Here's somebody wearing rags. They don't have a warm coat. They're probably wearing just what was called a tunic, an undershirt, basically, without a heavier outer garment to wear over top of it. And so they're cold. It's like somebody wandering around today with a t-shirt on. They're cold. And not only that, but hungry. It says they don't have daily food. And it's not just that they didn't have any food today. It's probably that they don't have regular meals. They're just fed by the kindness of strangers. And so here's this person who's in really tough conditions. And someone comes along and says, go in peace, be warmed, and be filled. You can see it's kind of a platitude, right? I mean, it's sort of a religious, you know, go in peace. By the way, even Jesus told people, go in peace. But it wasn't after he said, be warmed and be filled, right? It was after he had healed them and actually helped them. But this is equivalent today of somebody saying, hey, I see you're struggling. I'll pray for you. And then they walk away. And not only do they not provide the things they need, they also don't pray for them, probably. It's just empty words. Again, it's even a little bit insulting here, isn't it? In verse 16, where he says, be warmed and be filled. Well, how am I going to be warmed and how am I going to be filled if nobody comes along and actually gives me a coat or feeds me a meal? It's almost like a slap in the face. The point there here is not that James is saying real faith demonstrates itself by helping the poor. That's true. But his point here is simply to illustrate what he's said previously. Just like saying, I'm a Christian, but having no works to back it up, is like somebody saying, be warmed and be filled. You know, it's just empty words. That's all it is. And that's what James, I think, is fighting against very hard in this book. Yeah, you can say you believe all the things, but how is your faith demonstrated? Finally, James, here in this first section, shows us the illusion of faith that is contradicted by works. So in other words, if you have a counterfeit faith, it's going to be shown, it's going to be revealed, it's going to be exposed by works or lack of them. Verse 17, so also faith, again, by the way, so also, he's talking about that illustration. Just like that scenario, empty words don't mean anything. So faith, if it's just empty words, if it's by itself, that's, by the way, it's the key word there, by itself, it doesn't have works, it's dead. So James kind of stoops down here in verse 17 and he puts his finger on the pulse of this so-called faith and says, it's dead, Jim. It's gone. There's no life in this faith. It's not real. See, again, he's not saying that we need faith plus works. He's saying that a person is saved by true faith, not counterfeit faith. And how can we tell the difference? Because here's the thing. We can't look into somebody's heart. You can't dissect somebody and say, okay, you know, do they really, really believe, or are they just saying this? James says, we can't tell an internal on person, but we can tell their works. How does their life reflect the claims they're making? Faith by itself, if it's just words, is dead. And dead people don't do anything. So it is faith by itself is dead. It's rightly been said, and I think this is a helpful little phrase to memorize if you'd like, we're saved by faith alone, but the faith that saves is never alone. I'll say it again. We're saved by faith alone, but the faith that saves is never alone. You can't separate true faith from its product, good works. So if somebody claims to have faith in Christ, yet there's absolutely no evidence of the work of the Spirit, there's no evidence of a change in their lifestyle, there's no indication of God's work of conviction in their heart, James would check the pulse and say, this faith is dead. See, the kind of faith that saves you is the kind of faith that will change you. And those who preach the gospel, I think, understand this best. Sometimes those of us who are preachers or who are proclaiming the gospel see the difference between people who just respond with words only versus with a change of life. D.L. Moody, I'm sure, saw this a lot. He preached to hundreds of thousands, millions of people in his lifetime. And so I'm sure he was used to seeing people who, you know, responded in a moment of excitement, but only to find out their faith was like the parable of the sower. The roots went down, but there was no soil to grab onto. One time, Moody was preaching in Boston. And after he was finished preaching, he went back to his hotel. And as he entered the hotel lobby, he was stopped by a man there who said, Mr. Moody, I so admire your ministry. I actually came to faith at one of your meetings 14 years ago. And Moody, without missing a beat, asked him, what have you been doing since then? See, for Moody, it wasn't, oh, you had an exciting moment back 14 years ago, and then the rest of your life's been lived selfishly. He says, if you really believed, I want to see the change. I want to see the difference that's made in your life. So faith without works is dead faith. Second observation that James really wants us to see is that dead faith is not saving faith. Dead faith is not saving faith. Again, it's hinted at in verse 1. Can that faith save him? No. But he hits it a little more squarely here in verse 18 and 19. But if someone will say, you have faith and I have works, show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. So in these two brief verses, we learn, first of all, that saving faith is more than words. We've already established that, but look at verse 18. James introduces another character into this passage. He says, someone, again, a hypothetical, someone might say, you have faith, I have works. And so what I think this hypothetical debate partner is saying is he's saying, look, you have faith with works, you have faith without works, I have faith with works, you know, no big deal. Basically what he's saying is faith can still be faith. Works is kind of like an add-on. It's a bonus. It's not necessary to the overall package. Like, I've got works, cool. You don't have works, that's cool too. And James comes back in verse 18 and says, well, show me your faith apart from your works. You can't do it. Again, if there's no works to back up your faith, how am I supposed to be able to tell if it's real or not? Because again, anyone can say anything they want. But what proves it? And then he says, I will show you my faith by my works. Again, this is so important to grasp. If you want to understand what James is saying here, what he is saying is, you and I cannot see the reality of somebody's faith in their heart. We can only judge by what we can see, the externals. So James says, show me your faith apart from your works. I will show you my faith by my works. Again, it's a pretty clear logic that he's following here. We can only judge faith by its product. So faith is more than just words. Secondly, saving faith is more than orthodox belief. This is what we tend to, when we talk about faith, oftentimes we distill it down to this. Faith is believing the right things. Well, that's true, but is it anything more than that? See, faith is not just believing a set of facts, it's trusting yourself to the Savior. So verse 19, he says, you believe that God is one. Stop there. He's making reference here back to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6 is a great passage. It's sometimes called the Shema, which comes from the Hebrew word Shema, which means to hear. The reason it's called that is because that's the first word of the passage. It says, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. And this was the premier confession of Israel in ancient times. And frankly, today, even in Judaism, this is commonly recited. This is something that every Jew would say every single day. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. So this is like the foundation stone of Orthodox theology. There is one God. You claim Orthodox belief. You say that God is one. You do well. There's two sides to that phrase, you do well. Number one, he's saying, okay, correct. You're right. That's true. But I also think there's a little bit of sarcasm, don't you, in James' statement? He's like, you say these things, you do well. But if that's all you're doing, then you don't do well. He says, even the demons believe and shudder. Now, if you knew James before, you probably saw this coming. But think of James's original audience reading this for the first time. This would have been a shocking statement. You believe the confessions of Israel? Great. Even the demons believe that. Isn't it interesting to you that there are no atheists among demons? Demons don't have that problem, that belief system. They know that there is a God, and they know that he's powerful, and they know that there is one God who reigns and rules over the universe. But it doesn't mean that demons have saving faith, does it? They have a faith of some kind, right? A faith that affirms these true things, but not a faith that changes them. So to affirm that God is one is simply to affirm what is true. It's like saying, you know, water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Or there are 60 minutes in an hour. It's like, okay, those are true statements, and you're affirming that they're true. The demons affirm biblically true statements. Does that mean they have real saving faith? No. Saving faith is more than orthodox belief. Spyros Zodiates, which is kind of a fun name to say, he was an author who wrote about a lot of Christian topics, but he writes concerning this chapter, Christianity is not getting a few notions into our head, but it is the change of the seat of all of our affections and dispositions, a change of the heart. True, we begin with the head, but we travel to the heart, and from the heart we travel to the hand. So saving faith is more than just, hey, I checked off the boxes of, I believe, you know, the following, check, 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 check. But third, saving faith is more than emotional experience. Notice, by the way, the demons, it says they believe the true things about God. But then it says they shudder. Now that indicates that they're not believing in a way that accepts it. They believe it and shudder. they have an emotional response to this truth, right? It's a negative response. They're shuddering. They're fearful because they know they're on the wrong side and God is all powerful. But it's an emotional response. And I think some people look and say, well, you know, if somebody believes the right things and they feel really strongly about it, that's faith. That's real faith. Well, both of those things are a good indication that it might be, but it's not the sum total. Not according to James. He says you can have an emotional experience, like you can have feelings about what you believe. And you may even believe, quote unquote, the right things. But if it's not producing anything good in your life, is it really faith? James grew up around a lot of Pharisees. So did Jesus. So he was used to seeing this. People whose faith was orthodox. They would have said the Shema every morning. They were people who felt very strongly about their beliefs. But what did their lives suggest? Well, Jesus tells us. He says, you're like whitewashed tombs. Inside are dead men's bones. There's no real faith there. See, having an emotional response is not the measure of faith. Again, let me take you back to the parable of the seeds, the sower that Jesus tells. He says in that parable, the gospel goes out and some of that seed lands on rocky soil. And the plant grows up for a moment, but the soil hits solid limestone. And when that happens, the plant withers and dies. Here's Jesus' evaluation of the parable. Here's what he explains to the disciples. A person who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, so there's the emotional response. You know, they hear the message, they get excited about it for a moment. Yet here's what Jesus says. He has no root in himself. I think that's what James is saying. Listen, the fruit of your life comes from the root of your faith. If the root's not good, there's not going to be fruit. If the root is good, there will be fruit to show it. Now let me just pause here for a quick moment and say this, again, on a practical level. When we think about this as believers, is Jesus saying we have to live perfect lives? That unless I'm living perfectly, I can't really claim to be a person of faith? Let me just use this illustration of the root and the fruit for a minute. If you plant a seed for a tree and, you know, wait the requisite amount of time, the tree pops up, but it's not producing fruit. There's no fruit on the branches. In fact, you plant it, it grows for a little while, and then it's, you know, next thing you know, it's just this gnarled, dried up, old, scrubby bush. You'd say, well, that plant's dead. There's no life there. It's not producing fruit. Now take a tree that is healthy and growing and producing fruit. We all know that there are branches on that tree that are dead. There's fruit that comes out withered and parched. So I think there's a good comparison there to our Christian lives. Jesus is not saying, and certainly James isn't saying, that our lives have to be this absolute perfect reflection of Jesus. No, we're growing, we're learning. But if there's no fruit at all, if it's just a dead branch, is that real faith? Sometimes I think we maybe are concern ourselves by saying, well, you know, I'm not sure if I have real faith. I'm not really sure if I'm a believer because there's some bad fruits on the tree. Well, are there any good fruits on the tree? Is God doing anything in your life? Is there any evidence of the work of the Spirit? If there is, I trust that he's going to help take care of the bad fruits. And that takes a lot of time. So dead faith is not saving faith. And then finally, James kind of concludes this passage. And I know this is a huge portion. I'm trying to move as quickly as I can. He last insists that saving faith produces good works. Saving faith produces good works. It's not faith coupled with good works which saves. It doesn't add works to faith. It is faith alone that saves. But true and living faith produces fruit. That's what James is getting at. I like this little schematic here. We'll bring it up on the screen. This shows several ways of thinking about faith and works and how they function. The first one is works produces salvation. And we know that's not a Christian view at all. In fact, I don't know of any Christian that would hold entirely to the view that works, we have to work 100% for our salvation. Now, there are some who I think confuse, and they'll say, number two, that faith plus works equals salvation. So you still need faith, but it's faith plus you got to do your part. And I think that's a corruption of the gospel. And then you could also take the view that faith produces salvation, which, you know, again, we could point to a lot of scriptures that would say that. But I think James's position is best reflected in the last one. Faith produces salvation and works. So if it's true faith, it's producing, it's saving faith. It brings us into a relationship with God. But that's not all it does. It also changes our lives. It puts a love of God in our hearts. It, you know, again, to use the language of the Old Testament, it removes from us that heart of stone and gives us a heart of flesh that loves and obeys the law written on the heart. So James brings up two important examples here. And again, I got to go quickly through these because there's a lot we could say. But he begins with the example of Abraham. Verse 20. Do you want to be shown, O foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Again, I don't think James is just trying to be insulting there. I think what he's saying is, you know, if you deny this, you're a foolish person. Like if you can't see this connection. So he says, let me show you. Let me give you an example. Verse 21. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? Now again, you read that and you pause, especially if you've been reading elsewhere in the New Testament, especially in Romans, and you say, something doesn't sound right about this. Paul, for instance, in Romans chapter 4, verse 2, he says, you see a person, he says, for if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. So you think to yourself, wait a second, I thought we were justified by grace apart from works. Faith alone, right? And yet here he's saying Abraham was justified not by faith, but by works. So who's right, Paul or James? We need to explain something. First of all, Paul and James use some of similar terminology, but they use it in different ways. So if we understand how they're using these words, it'll clear up the so-called contradiction here. The word justify, for instance, it's used twice here in this passage, once in verse 24, once in verse 21. It has the idea, and Paul uses it, to mean made righteous before God. Justified means to be made righteous, declared righteous. But the word justify can also mean to vindicate. For instance, we use this in English where we'll say, you know, somebody's actions were justified given the circumstances. They were justified to act in that way. Or we might say it of a country, you know, this nation was justified to declare war on this other nation because of whatever happened. They were justified. They were vindicated by that. So the difference is how they're using it. Paul uses it as declared righteous. James is using it to mean vindicated. Secondly, we have to think about their audiences. Paul is talking about justification in terms of a Godward relationship. Paul is talking about justification as our standing before God. But for James, the audience is other people. It's those who are looking on to our lives. So in other words, Paul is concerned with how a person is made right before God. James is concerned with how we can identify real faith. Paul focuses on faith leading to salvation. James focuses on faith following salvation. Or here's how one author said it. Paul is explaining how one gains entrance into heaven. James is examining how one gives evidence of it. So let me use this little brief illustration to hopefully see the difference between what Paul and James are doing. Picture a house with a fireplace. Paul is sitting inside the house. He's kind of getting an insider look, and he's looking at the fire in the fireplace as a person's faith. And he says, this person has faith, that are saved by faith and faith alone. But James's perspective, he's somebody walking past the house. He can't see the fire inside. He can't see whether or not there's faith dwelling in this person. But he can look for evidence. So he looks up at the chimney, and out is a stream of smoke. That smoke is the works. That's the evidence that there's faith inside the house. So when Paul is talking about faith, he's talking about it in terms of the fire, the flames in the hearth. James is talking about it in terms of evidence. So when he says Abraham was justified by his works, basically what he's saying is he was vindicated. His faith was proven by his works. And what work in particular? Well, he mentions offering up his son Isaac on the altar. That was the proof that he trusted God, that he was a person of faith. He acted on that faith. In fact, we read in Hebrews that he believed God so thoroughly. He believed the promises would be fulfilled, that he would have a line through Isaac, that even if he sacrificed his own son, God would bring him back to life. This faith that Abraham had was vindicated. It was justified before other people, before anybody who would look on. You know, was Abraham a person of faith? Look at his actions. His actions justify his claim to faith. Verse 22, you see that faith was active along with his works. In other words, it wasn't faith or works. He says it was faith and works that were displayed in his life. His faith was demonstrated by his works, or in this case, he says completed by his works, perfected. In other words, the faith was made known by what he did. And that really results in verse 23, where God says he was called a friend of God. So what works did Abraham produce? Well, he produced righteousness that changed his life. It changed him from being a pagan into a friend of God. There was evidence in his life that something wonderful had happened. But then finally, and again, I'm moving kind of quick through this, but James uses one last illustration, one last example. And he picks somebody the complete opposite of Abraham. Abraham's the father of faith. He's the father of the Jewish people. You know, wonderful example, a person of strong faith. But somebody might say, well, you know, okay, strong faith produces work, but weak faith doesn't always. So James says, well, let me give you another example. Rahab, she didn't have all the advantages. I mean, Abraham had God speaking to him on numerous occasions. All Rahab had was stories she had heard that Israel had come out of Egypt with a strong hand, that God had smited the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues, that God had parted the sea before them. And she says, I want to be on that side. I want to follow that God. So it says in verse 25, and in the same way, Rahab the prostitute was justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. Now, if you want to hear more about Rahab's life and her story, we're going to be talking about that in our study on Wednesday nights in Hebrews 11. But for now, notice that she too was justified by her works. She was vindicated. Her faith was demonstrated by what she did. See, she chose to identify with God's people rather than the Canaanites. She chose to harbor the Israelite spies. Basically, what she was saying was, I accept your God as the true God. I want to be his follower. But she didn't just say that. They weren't just words. She backed it up with her actions. She hung the red cord from the window. She hid the spies. She wasn't just talk. She was works. All right, so last verse, we close it up. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. There's the thesis. There's what James has been saying all along. Faith without works is dead. Please remember, salvation is by grace through faith, not works. We're saved by faith. But true faith changes us. It's accompanied by good works. Think of this example. Imagine there's a stormy night and a child and his family are safely in their home and suddenly lightning strikes in the yard and a tree is struck, catches on fire. The fire spreads, but you know, eventually the rain puts it out. So the next morning, the boy comes outside with his father, and they look at the damage. And the son says, "Father, what caused the damage last night? Was it the lightning or the thunder?" Well, clearly the answer is the lightning, right? The lightning did the damage. But you don't have lightning without thunder, right? And so it is. Faith saves. It's not faith plus the thunder that saves. It's faith plus nothing. But if it's real faith, it's going to make a sound. There's going to be some change that comes about. So if I can put it pretty plainly, I would say it this way. The kind of faith that saves you is the kind of faith that changes you. The kind of faith that saves you is the kind of faith that changes you. Now let me, in the couple minutes we have left, simply say this. That salvation is by faith alone without works. That anyone who comes to the Lord and receives the free gift, there's nothing that you're required to do. There's no ceremony you have to go through. Even if you are at 11:59 in your life and you have nothing in your hand to bring, God will receive based upon faith. Real faith, but faith. I read this past week that the creator of the Dilbert cartoon, Scott Adams, died, age 68, after a pretty extensive battle with cancer. And from what I read, and I didn't do a whole lot of reading on this, but from what I read, he professed Christ as his Lord before he died. You may say, well, he didn't live long enough to do any good works. Well, God receives based upon faith. The question is, what kind of faith was it? And that's where I don't know. I hope that it was a true confession of faith and that he cast himself upon the grace of God. If that's the case, then he is in heaven right now with God. But we can't always know what's in this person's heart. But that we can look for evidence of a change in somebody. See, faith isn't just empty words. It's a life-transforming belief. I want you to hear this quote. I think this captures well what James is trying to say. Oh, it is a living, busy, active, mighty thing, this faith. This faith, it is so impossible for it not to do good works. It does not ask whether there are good works to do, but before the question rises, it has already done them and is always doing them. He who does not do these works is a faithless man. He gropes and looks after faith and good works and knows neither of them, though he talks and he talks with many words about faith and good works. In other words, faith is known by its works. That quote, by the way, is taken from the preface to a commentary on Romans written by Martin Luther, who apparently had a problem with James. But I don't know why, because he expresses exactly what James here was saying. So maybe Paul and James aren't contradicting after all, and maybe Luther and James aren't really that different after all either.